Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Property and Local Tax Division to order. At the insistence of Ms. Hawkins, Representative Nelson, can you move the March 13th, 2013 minutes, please? Yes. So moved. Thank you. Any discussion to the March 13th, 2013 minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And also, Representative Vertas.
Yes, sir.
I believe you are an active participant on the March 19th minutes. Would you move their approval, sir?
I will move those. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Vertas motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much. We are going to rearrange the agenda some from the printed document that's available for the public out of respect, the traditional respect for, first of all, or partially members who are not members of the committee, and also, and more importantly, real citizens, real people who come from outside the metropolitan area. So we're going to start with Representative Lean's bill, House File 1608, to accommodate some of his testifiers who actually came from quite a distance. So with that, Representative Lean, would you like to move your bill, sir?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move House File 1608 to be heard and possibly included in the division omnibus, or excuse me, the division report.
Very good. Thank you very much. With that, Representative Lean, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1608 is the establishing a new formula for the local government aid program and also appropriating $80 million for the program. I think this is a very important bill for a couple reasons. The last time LGA was reformulated was 2002 and has since received quite a lot of criticism in the last couple of years. Some of that criticism was seen in a study group, the Local Government Aid Study Group, convened in 2009, which had a couple findings, major findings. The three most important findings were that the formula, the current formula, is too complex and hard to understand. There's a lack of predictability, and thus it makes it hard for local governments to budget. And that some of the factors that go into establishing need for cities are out of date and, well, don't make sense. I think it's also indicative that along with the appropriation in the governor's budget, he had also kind of started this conversation to take a look at reformulating the need structure for LGA. And before I get into the bill, I would like to move an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, to get it in the form that I would prefer.
Thank you very much. Representative Lean moves the H1608 A1 amendment, so author's amendment, to get the bill in the form that he prefers. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Hearing none. Oh, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I heard, but I saw.
Did not hear, but I saw. Lean, why are you striking federal census?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, from what I understand, and Ms. Dalton can maybe explain this in a little better detail, but what I understand is that this will allow us to take a look at the American City Survey's information.
Ms. Dalton, can you assist here, please?
For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. The issue is that the long form of the federal census was replaced by the American Community Survey Act, an annual survey, and it looks at five-year weighted averages. Even if we were not changing the formula, we should be updating this to just talk about data provided by the United States Bureau of the Census as opposed to the federal census.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton, I wonder, though, how many of those were returned, because I received calls on those. I don't know if my constituency was returning them. So I don't know if that's an accurate document to use anyway.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it is an issue with actually, frankly, all census data. The data is better the larger the locality, and that's actually one of the things that this formula or this new proposal does, it does not use any census data for any city under 2,500 anymore. So that should help, hopefully mean that the data that is being used for the cities, the larger and medium-sized cities, are better data. But this is the only source of the housing data now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other discussion to the A1 amendment? Neither seeing nor hearing any. All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lean, to your bill as amended, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just briefly here touch on the different sections of the bill, allow Ms. Dalton to give some testimony on to some of the more data-driven details of the bill. We also have a couple testifiers from some of the city groups to give some testimony in support of the bill.
Excellent.
Section 1 of the bill establishes a definition for one of the need factors in both the medium city and the large city measures, and that is pre-1940 housing percentage, or the percentage of housing built before 1940. The second section lays out a definition for the percent of housing built between 1940 and 1970, which is a need factor. Give me one. Which is a need factor in the large city measure. Section 3 of the bill gets into establishing the different need factors for the three different size cities. And this is something that I think folks really coalesced around, an idea folks really coalesced around, is having sort of a three-tier system of need factors based on three different size cities. So, for example, small cities or cities with a population less than 2,500, the need factor is based on population, with a per capita amount going to cities which would be between $410 per capita and $630 per capita, again based on population. For medium-sized cities between 2,500 and 10,000, the need factors, there are three need factors, pre-1940 housing, household size, and population decline since 1970, or in other words, taking into account the peak population since 1970 and what that population is in the current year. For cities larger than 10,000, we have, again, the pre-1940 housing percentage, the percentage of housing built between 1940 and 1970, and jobs per capita. Section 3 also gets into some of the transition factors for cities going from the small city measure to the medium-sized city measure. In other words, cities between 2,500 and 3,000. And again, for cities going between the medium size to the large size, which would be cities transitioning and allowing for some transition between 10,000 and 10,500. And the third area in Section 3 pertains to inflation as a measure with the revenue need, and this is something that is similar to current law, so it's basically the revenue need times the inflation factor. Section 4 of the bill lays out the jobs per capita definition, which again was one of the need measures for the large cities. Section 5 lays out the definition for peak population decline, and again that was one of the need factors for the medium-sized cities, which again was population decline from the peak since 1970. Section 6 of the bill lays out the formula aid for a city, and this basically establishes once a city has its need measure, it lays out the amounts of money that would go to a city. So basically for 2014, the city's formula aid would be the 2013 certified aid plus the difference between its unmet need and its 2013 certified aid times the aid gap percentage. And for 2015 and going forward, it would be very similar. We would just be taking the previous year's numbers. Section 7 of the bill is taking a look at the city aid distribution, which is the city formula aid amount and then taking into account different adjustments. And those adjustments are laid out in Section 8 of the bill. Now, these adjustments for the cities of Newport, Crookston, and Mendota will be phased out either 2013 or 2014. Section 9 of the bill is the appropriation amount, and in the original bill, this was blank. In the amendment, it has been amended to an amount of $506,438,012. And we did that so that with some of the runs we had for the amount of aid a city would get under the new formula, we would have sort of a number to go off of, sort of a number to base those runs off of. Section 10 of the bill talks about inflation, which is a new idea for the new formula, and basically the inflation allows for an increase in appropriation based on inflation and growth in city populations around the state. Now, this inflation factor will be between 2.5% and 5%, and Section 11 of the bill repeals old language that was used for the old formula.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dalton, do you have information to add to that presentation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think probably the biggest difference in the new formula versus the formula in current law is that what the formula really works is distributing is trying to meet the difference between what a city needs and what they currently receive. And so this doesn't take money from cities based on their relative share. However, you don't get new money unless you have need, unmet need that exceeds what you are currently getting. If you have unmet need that is less than what you are currently getting, beginning in 2015, you can have a decrease. And the decrease is very similar to the decrease allowed under current law, which is the lesser of $10 per capita or 5% of your previous year's levy. And
all right.
Mr. Chair, and the other thing I would say is that one of the other differences is that this LGA formula is scalable, unlike current law. So if you have unmet need that is not currently paid for out of your certified aid, you will get a portion of the new money. And how big your portion is, it is determined by how far you are from that unmet need right now. So if, you know, as I said, this bill is, the printouts are modeled on $80 million. If the printouts were modeled on $100 million, the same cities would be winners. It's just that they would get more. If it was modeled on $60 million, again, the same cities would be winners. They would just get proportionately less.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this first question is for Ms. Dalton. Now, back before 2003, a large percent of the aid was grandfathered in versus really formula-based. And after 2003, I think it was down to about 5% grandfathered. 5%, yeah, grandfathered, and the rest was aid. So what would that be now? Is there anything grandfathered now, or is it all off the formula?
Ms. Dalton.
Am I explaining myself correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, the formula determines the need in all cases except one, and that is for the city of War Road. There is a guaranteed $150,000 for 5 years. One of the things that the LGA study group had suggested was to go back and look at all the grandfathers that have been granted over the years, and this was the only one they decided to keep, but following what the LGA study group had said, they did put a sunset date on it, so the city has to come back in and make a case for the money if they wanted to continue.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, Ms. Dalton, has there ever been a time where this much of it has been based on the formula versus grandfather?
Ms. Dalton?
I know when it first started, it was kind of based on even revenues or what they spent, but how are we sitting in comparison to historic numbers on
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in some ways that's a little hard to say because there was some similarity to this back in the early 70s in terms of increases were distributed via the formula. However, the difference between what was going on in the 70s and now is there were no decreases if the formula said you didn't need it.
Right.
Whereas under this formula, if the formula says you don't need what you are currently getting, you can lose.
And
Representative Markowitz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just one comment off of that. I do think the formula, the more it is off the formula, the more credibility it has, rather than when you have all the grandfather, which really doesn't get to the true need. So, you know, I know over the years, and I think Ms. Dalton has come back to this about every 11 years or something like that. There's a cycle when we end up redoing this. But I think it's important that we do, because much of this, I think, is the credibility and confidence that not only legislators, but cities around the state have in a formula based on something that really is need. And you can, you know, you come to a lot to try to agree on what that formula is. But once it's set, I think it's important that you do have as much possible on the formula. It sounds like we're almost completely formula now. So thank you. So all those who, Chair Dabney, I know you were very involved in all the city groups and Representative Lean and Ms. Dalton and staff, thank you so much for coming together and putting together a formula that I think is very workable.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I'd never like to disagree with House staff, but just to be clear, you brought up the term, taking care of unmet needs. Just to be clear, we have a health care funding crisis, an education funding crisis, a legislative pay funding crisis. There are scads of funding crises at this Capitol. Regardless of how much taxes are raised, there will always be unmet needs coming to this Capitol for local government aid and other services. So, but that's not my question, and I certainly would never want to ask a question of staff to get in the debate on it. But my question is for the author of the bill, particularly on page 6 and 7, section 10 of the bill. This has to do with the Representative Lean with the inflation adjustment measure, and you're using the implicit price deflator for government expenditures and gross investment in state and local government purchases, which every member of the committee should know. If they don't know, I'll state this. They are far more likely to grow faster than the traditional form of inflation, the consumer price index. And what no one would dispute is that when you take that and you track it versus personal income, that implicit price deflator grows faster than personal income. Now, there's a 2.5% and a 5% cap on there. But my question is that it looks like we're autopiloting some automatic spending increases in the LGA formula. In the event that personal income comes up short of that, how are we going to pay for that?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo. You know, to be honest, that was actually one of the concerns I had was this to me looks like it's money that's just going to automatically be appropriated, and what check or what balance do we have to take care of that, take that into account. You know, I do like the idea, though, that this formula will grow as cities grow. And I certainly understand the concerns about the inflation factor here being higher than personal income, but this inflation factor is for the price that local governments have to pay to provide services. So I think it's a more accurate factor of inflation for the purposes of this money. And as to how those numbers were arrived at between 2.5% and 5%, possibly Ms. Schill can provide more detail on that.
Ms. Dalton?
Excuse me, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the formula is very similar to the appropriation increase that existed in the LGA formula between 1993 and 2003 that was removed in 2003 under the governor's bill. I did actually take a look at what the IPD is projected to be for the next 6 years, and it tends to be between 2% and 2.3%. The IPD for the Consumer Price Index, you are right, is slightly lower. It tends to vary between 1.7% and 2% during that same time period. Generally, the CPI is slightly lower than the IPD. However, that's not entirely the case. There have actually been 2 years in the last four where the IPD was actually lower than the CPI.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to staff, when I look at 2010 through 2013, I see 1 year. I see 2009, and that's primarily as a result of the effects of the federal stimulus, which was not priced in the state and local government. As everyone knows, state and local units of government cut expenditures in the local level and filled in those potholes with federal stimulus money. But the numbers I have for CPI versus IPD, that's not the case. So maybe I would have to review with staff the sources of our information to see if they're, if we're getting divergent data. But my question, another question, Representative Lean, is that you made the statement that this is what local units of government are paying, and unfortunately, or I guess I should say fortunately, that's not the case, because this is a national measurement, and what happens is disproportionately states like California and New York, when they fund massive salary and benefits increases for their public employees, actually distort the national measurement of inflation. It's the mother of all circular references. The reason why costs for government are going up is because government is spending more money. Therefore, they need additional money to pay for these costs. And so my concern is that we are putting on autopilot spending measures that are going to be above personal income growth. And so I'll just, from a math perspective, I will ask, in the event that these, you know, these inflation measures track what they are versus personal income growth, and we have the implicit price deflator growing automatically faster than personal income, how are we going to pay for this?
Representative Lean, do 134 members of the House and 67 members of the Senate and the governor have any influence over what happens to the LGA formula in future years?
I would imagine they would through appropriations, Mr. Chair.
Oh, really?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate
Representative Garofalo.
I appreciate the attempt at least being humorous, but I asked a question. I'll ask it a third time, Representative Lean. In the event that we continue to see this trend where spending grows at is automatically pegged to grow at a faster rate than personal income growth, what will subsequent legislatures have to do to address that?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I do appreciate your concerns. And again, those were the same concerns I had. That was one of my first questions about this bill, was taking a look at that built-in growth of the inflation. You know, how is that going to be taken into account? And that was my understanding of why that number was used for this bill, is so that it's a way to accurately address inflation for what governments have to address in order to provide the services.
And Mr. Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Lean, I understand your intent for the bill. I understand that you want to provide additional resources to communities through local government aid. My question for you is, in the event that you have the data going forward, track what it has in the past, that you have measures of government inflation growing faster than personal income, what are subsequent legislatures to do to correct that problem?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, you know, I would have to defer to House staff as far as how...
That's okay. No, Mr. Chairman.
Let him finish. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say, Representative Garofalo, I'd have to defer back to House staff as to what measures could be taken.
Mr.
Representative
Chairman,
Garofalo.
And I'll answer the question for the gentleman. What the subsequent legislatures will have to do is take appropriations from other areas of the budget and put it into LGA, or we're going to have to raise taxes. That's what we're going to have to do, because what we're doing is we're baking into the brownies for future budget forecasts automatic spending increases that are faster than personal income growth. And that's not an ideological concern. It's not a political philosophy concern. That's a problem with math. And we're seeing a lot of challenges with math in this current legislature and this current governor, and this is another example of the concerns I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Any other questions from members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question goes to staff. I'd like to have a little better explanation of how the revenue need formulas were established, how those numbers were selected to determine just what the city's needs are.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the formulas were actually developed, for the most part, statistically. There was a regression analysis done. The small city formula is actually based on an analysis that was originally done but has been updated for a bill that was introduced by Representative Marquardt back in 2007 that looked at spending patterns for smaller cities on a per capita basis, and there turned out to be a pattern that was very apparent graphically. And so because so much data is somewhat suspect for the smallest cities, I mean, we have cities with a population of 17 in this state, the decision was made to just go with the population measure for need for the smallest cities, for the cities under 2,500, using that analysis updated to get the coefficients for it. For the medium and large cities, originally there was some look at trying to do all of them together. However, some of the initial analysis showed that there were different factors that explained different spending at or revenue need, which was what was used as the dependent variable, which has always been used as dependent variable in both the 2003 LGA and the 1993 LGA. Revenue base is a measure of levy plus aid for each city, including the taconite aids, and it is used as a proxy for spending. That number is regressed on factors that have been identified by the interested parties, in this case the members who were meeting and the city organizations, as factors that they felt were important in explaining variation in spending. But statistical analysis was used to determine, number one, whether those factors were important, and then what weight to give to those factors.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you for that. I got some of it, frankly.
I feel your pain.
I've been looking at this most of the day, and my head hurts. But so is it in your opinion that these formulas are accurate?
Representative Dalton, opinion?
Representative Dalton? Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the one thing I've always told people throughout my 20-some years of doing this is that there are a number of ways that you can measure need, and how good a formula is in measuring need is if it makes sense. And as I said, the legislators looked at the factors that we considered, and so did the city groups, and they felt that they could explain what these factors measured as it relates to city spending. And there is some statistical validity. It does explain variation in spending between cities. Does it explain all variation? No. Both of these formulas only explain roughly 50% of the variation in the revenue base. But if we had just updated the coefficients for the current formula, we were explaining less than 30% of the variation in spending for cities.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for Ms. Dalton, we're establishing this need figure for all the cities, but we're not going to meet that need instantly by any means. Have you estimated how long it will take, given the estimated inflation in here, until we actually get to the point where we have met these city need figures?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, no, I have not. Basically, what this formula right now is going to fill with the $80 million, it's going to fill 19% of the gap between need and what is currently being distributed. But I have not figured out how many years it would take with inflation and appropriation increases before all of it is filtered.
Representative Torkelson.
Would you care to select between years, decades, and centuries?
It'll change.
Yeah. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would say closer to a decade than two decades. I would say it would, just because of compounding, I would guess it's, you know, going to be somewhere in the 8 to 15 year range. But again, it will depend on inflation. If you're growing at 2.5% and compounding, that's much different than growing at 5% and compounding.
Perhaps you'd like to start, Representative Torkelson, a pool.
Perhaps I would. Maybe we could pay for a stadium.
It might generate more revenues than current.
Just one final question.
Representative Torkelson?
No, I forgot my question. I will leave it for later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, in your introduction to the bill, you pointed out that there's a great need. Part of the original premise of local government aid and property tax relief to cities by giving them aid would offer their property taxpayers relief. Why is it then in your bill that about 50% of the population of Minnesota is ignored under the formula?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dalton?
I think I'll defer to Ms. Dalton.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Hertas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, about one-fourth of the population in Minnesota is located in townships, and townships are not eligible for LGA. We have not paid LGA to townships in a dozen years. I'm looking at Steve, hoping he remembers the exact year. I believe it was 2001 was the last year we paid township aid. And we didn't pay very much even back then.
And there's a nod in the back of the room. So you look this way, I'll look that way. And between the two, I think we've got it.
And even back then, it was about $3 per capita is what we were paying in township aid. Other quarter of the state that is not getting LGA are cities that, because of their high tax base per capita, do not have what the formula considers unmet need. That they are able to meet the need that the formula calculates for them using an average city tax rate times their tax base. So if they have a very high tax base, they can raise enough locally that they don't need state aid, and so therefore they aren't getting any under the formula. And that's same as what's going on in current law.
Ms. Dalton, how many cities receive, under this proposal, LGA? How many cities receive police and fire aid to help their budgets with that area of spending? Do you know off the top of your head?
Mr. Chair, I actually looked this up right before I came down. Under current law, there's 107 cities who do not get LGA. Under this formula being proposed in House File 1608, there are 85 cities who will get no aid, and all 853 or 54 cities currently get police and fire aid.
So, Ms. Dalton, just to clarify, those 85 cities that do not get LGA under the Lean proposal do get police and fire aid. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe so.
All right.
No.
Thank you very much.
That's not correct?
No.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's correct. Metro cities, for example, many of them who are small cities do not get any fire and police aid whatsoever. And as a mayor, I can tell you that that's true. With regard to the formula, though, I guess the question is why are many small metro cities exempted from this formula? Why is there, with regard to talking about average tax capacity per capita, that infers that because you have a low population and a high or a higher per capita tax capacity, that somehow infers an ability to meet need on an individual household basis. I can tell you it's really quite just the opposite. This formula totally ignores even taking the total tax capacity of a city into consideration. You know, LGA was targeted at those communities who didn't have tax capacity in order to generate the revenues to provide the basic needs of police and fire. So this formula, I think, is a bad formula. It totally ignores it, and we've got many suburbs in the third suburban ring, fourth suburban ring, on the edge of the metro that simply have low numbers of households, low numbers of rooftops, very low city budgets. They're unable to pass city budgets to take care of basic needs. They're unable to pass school tax levy referenda to take care of schools. And these are the very communities that should be targeted for LGA. And yet we're giving 50% of total LGA to a handful of cities. 75% of the 850 cities, if I have my facts right, in Minnesota are under 5,000 in population, have relatively low tax capacities and low populations. I don't understand, Mr. Chair, why we are ignoring the total tax capacity in this formula.
Representative Hertas, what aspect of tax capacity is not being contemplated in this formula?
When you take a whole community, let's use Minneapolis-St. Paul, for example. They have a huge tax capacity in order to levy and raise their own funds to take care of their basic needs, to provide fire and police. And then you go out into these small towns, they have little ability to produce the revenue necessary to provide police and fire. That's my argument. You go from billions of dollars of tax capacity in large cities to a few hundred million dollars, if even that, in some of the cities, particularly metro communities. I can tell you that 11 of the 11 cities in my district in West Hennepin County, 9 of them get zero LGA, but yet they're all taxpayers to the LGA system and in this redistribution. But there's many of these communities that should be getting government aid. We're talking about communities that have budgets of less than $1.5 million. We've got maybe 700 or 800 rooftops, and this formula just—it's not good enough. It needs to be fixed.
Representative Hertas, is that 9 out of 11 communities in your district current law or the proposed formula? And does that number change under the proposed formula?
Current and proposed, there's no change, and we need to do something to fix this.
All right. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I do want to correct, because I phoned a friend while we were talking. Cities and cities who choose to contract for their police and fire service with another entity, they do not get police and fire aid because they don't have a department.
Okay.
And there are small cities who that's what they do.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
And that's the very thing that we should be encouraging in communities is consolidation and sharing of services. We don't need a ladder truck in every town. That's the very thing we should be doing. And that shouldn't be a reason to be disqualifying for that service. Nonetheless, you take these same small cities are spending 25-30% of their annual budgets just in contract for police and fire services. And it's a heavy burden, even if it's contracted out. So we're not adequately addressing some of these communities with this current law. And I would hope that the author of the bill would take that into consideration.
All right. Other questions from members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to my earlier line of questioning. In the future, if a legislature finds it impossible to add more money to the formula, what would be the impact?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, I suppose we would have to draft an amendment or come up with a certain way to rework the formula.
No, you wouldn't.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, what happens is there would, most cities would stay essentially getting what they were getting the previous year if there was no new money. The exception would be any city that has unmet need less than what they are currently getting. That money would be cut and redistributed to cities who still have an unmet need aid gap. But that would be a relatively minor movement of money.
Representative Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then just one more scenario. If there should be a cut in total LGA, is this formula, would this formula accommodate a cut?
Representative Dalton. Or, sorry, Ms. Dalton. Did I do that again? Is that the second time I've done that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm. You phone a friend on questions. I'm going to get coffee. I'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Mr. Chair, right now the formula is not set up to anticipate that. So if there was a cut in appropriation, there would have to be some language changes to address that. It assumes either a constant appropriation level or an increased appropriation level.
Representative Torkelson.
So, and that would be true no matter where in this, you know, say we were near the end of this cycle in that second decade, that would be so even at that point in time?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe that would be correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I forgot. I'm confounded what bearing how old the housing stock of private property has with regard to calculating what your benefit should be. Could you explain that to me, Representative Lean?
Representative Lean.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas. If I'm reading your question correct, the age in housing stock would take into account, excuse me, let me find my notes here. It would take into account, as a city declines or as the age of a city goes on, that you would still have to maintain certain infrastructures for that city.
Mr. President Hertas.
Well, how that's normally done is streets and other things are have a useful life. Those things are replaced and assessed to the benefiting property owner. There is a mechanism in place that takes care of that. So what bearing with regard to providing other services like police and fire does how old a house of private property have to do with anything with the number of constituents that are served?
Ms. Dalton, since you worked on developing the formula, proxy is the latest word in my vocabulary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson.
No, it says Hertas.
I apologize. Representative Hertas. The use of the word proxy is a very good word to be using in this. It's very difficult to measure city need directly, unlike school districts where you can say you are serving a student and you are serving a kindergartner or a high schooler. There are very concrete ways to measure what you are serving. That's not the case for cities. So the factors that show up in the city formulas are often considered to be proxies for other things that are not measurable. In the case of the age of housing stock, it is a proxy for both development level of a city and also the age of the infrastructure. If you have a lot of houses that were built before 1940 or a lot of houses built between 1940 and 1970, you tend to have aging infrastructure. And you are right, special assessments can cover some of the costs, but they can't cover replacements that do not increase the value of the property. And so that is a increased cost that cities incur when their infrastructure is aging. And so that is actually what it's primarily a proxy for.
Representative Hertas, anything else?
Well, my counter to that argument is that usually those things are considered with regard to the market and the price and the value of property. So usually those things are taken into consideration and are discounted, even to the extent that if you know that a a looming pending assessment is imminent, that will tend to drive the price down of the property. So there's compensating factors for that. Those are market-driven, not government-driven. So I just think that this formula, and particularly with aging of house stock, tends to favor who's going to get the LGA as opposed to a fair and equal distribution of LGA dollars.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, one of the major purposes of local government aid has always been known as kind of the great equalizer. And I know as part of the formula, it's to try to measure, you know, what is your ability to raise revenue. And it's kind of a equalization of effort. And one thing I'd like to see, which we don't have the data, it might help answer Representative Hertas's questions a little bit, would be as, like, what would 1% of tax rate raise in dollars per capita? And I think that would be very revealing, because what we find out typically would be that those cities that are receiving LGA, that would be much lower versus those cities that do not. And I think that's kind of the main purpose of local government aid. And I think what everyone's trying to do is to say, no matter where you live in this state, that $1 of effort or 1% of effort is going to get you roughly the same amount of services. Because if you buy a fire truck in one area, it costs the same somewhere else. It's, you don't get it cheaper because you're in a place with a lower tax base and so forth. But I want to focus on one other area of the bill that we haven't so far, and that's the increase in the $80 million. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Representative Lean, I applaud you for bringing this forward, because we know that there's been hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts to local government aid over the last 10 years, and cities are feeling that. And so I applaud you for bringing this $80 million forward. Still not getting to where we were, but what are you hearing from cities? I mean, what's the need there for cities for this extra $80 million in local government aid?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markworth. You know, I haven't heard specific numbers from cities as far as where what they would need to get them to a level that would be comparable had those cuts not taken place. I know from my own hometown, Moorhead, we are roughly at $340,000 less in 2012 than what we saw in 2003. So, excuse me, $349,000 less. So that's just one example. What I have heard from cities, though, Coalition of Greater Minnesota, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, League of Cities, the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, is that there's overwhelming support for this proposal, not just for the new formula, but also for that appropriation, that it's, you know, at least a starting point to get us back to where we were before a lot of those cuts.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lean, besides the numbers, I mean, what are they talking about as far as where they could put those dollars? What type of services?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Markworth. It's for Moorhead, I know it's snow plowing, for one. As Moorhead's growing, we've seen a lot of growth in the southeast sector of the city, so that's all new infrastructure, new street maintenance, new sewer water. Along with that growth and expansion of cities, there's police officers to be hired on to maintain public safety. There's firefighters to maintain public safety. So it's really, as cities have grown in those last 10 years, just getting back to a place where they would be able to provide these fundamental services for their communities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Markworth. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lean, thank you for bringing this. Representative Herkel, you know, you talk about cities with housing older than 1940. I know cities with housing from 1880, with the sewers that are still serving them. Those sewers have a lifetime of 50 years. And they've gone over 75 years. I don't know how they do it, but they do. I have more than 120-year-old housing in my district. And fortunately, St. Paul, about 40 years ago, redid those when I think the state required us to separate out the sewer and the rain gutters. So in 10 years, those sewers that have already been replaced once will have to be replaced again. That's what local government aid does. That's how they can do, the cities can do that when they are not raising the value of your property by changing your sewer. This state has so many infrastructure problems laying out in front of it, from bridges over freeways, bridges over creeks, sewers, water lines. They just replaced over 100-year-old water lines that were serving a manufacturer in my district that had 3,000 people working in it. And when they pulled out the lines that were 18-inch lines, they were down to about 4 or 5 inches because of the gunk that was built up into them. So that's what local government aid is doing. And that's how they figure when housing is over prior 1940 or 1940 to 1970. That's how that particular formula was formulated. I managed to get up early on a variety of Mondays to go sit through them, which was just a pleasurable experience. No, the cookies were the best, I have to say. The cookies were the best. So when you want to try and denigrate this particular formula because we based it on the one thing that was calculable on infrastructure needs of a town, whether it's western Minnesota, southern Minnesota, or in the metro area, understand that that infrastructure, and as a builder, you should understand how the lifetime of infrastructure is. And how do you replace it? Do you want us to raise property taxes to do that, or you just want us to let it collapse? We have some choices. And we as a state, I think the choice should be that we help small and large and mid-sized cities replace their infrastructure so people can live the healthy lives that we're supposed to live.
Representative Firtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't suggesting that we should be rationing how much people eat or drink to save the sewers. I understand that aspect of it. But, you know, we've listened to a lot of rhetoric in all of the campaign and all of the things we approach about fairness. We all have a definition of fairness. And, you know, I just think that the formula unfortunately ignores many communities who also have need and fails to recognize them at all. And when Representative Lean just mentioned that his city is getting about $350,000 less, I'm thinking to myself, as past mayor of our community, $350,000 less, we would be tickled to death if we got $25,000 or $30,000, because that's a big part of a budget. We're not talking about second suburban rings with $200 million budgets here. I'm talking about small towns, you know, that are running on $1 million, $1.5 million, running really mean and lean and doing as best they can do for their taxpayers. So I also applaud, you know, the effort to offer property tax relief to all Minnesotans. And I say that to all Minnesotans. And I think that's one of the problems with the formula is that it falls short of recognizing more cities, the 850 cities we have, and it's falling short of that, and I think we could do a better job. I'm not saying we should totally corrupt the system in favor of everybody being on a level or equal playing field. If that were the case, we could just say, well, we got $500 million we're spending plus another $80 million. Let's just divide it all by the 5.5 million people that live in the state, and let's just pass out $100 to every community based on population. I mean, that might be, you know, a formula that is truly fair, but I'm not asking for that. But I think we're ignoring by population, by size, by total tax capacity of the city. I think it's more complicated than it's being made in this simple formula, and I think we're falling short, and I think we as a legislature have the ability to do a better job than we're doing on this issue.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Herkoff. That's actually kind of what we did early on with the LGA. We kind of flew over the state and threw nickels and dimes out, and hopefully they grew into trees that had money for people to pick off of, or cities and towns to pick off. I have a question for Ms. Dalton. See, I got the name right.
Extra credit.
It's always good to pick on the chair. How many cities are there in the state?
Ms. Dalton?
Well, encompassed in the, I'll phrase it this way. How many cities are receiving LGA, how many are not receiving LGA, and then I'll total it together and we can do a percentage, because I think it's less than 10%.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, out of the 854 cities, and I always say that because I always forget when we've added or subtracted a city, but I'm going to say 854 cities, 107 do not get LGA under current law. Under this bill, 85 will not get LGA.
I knew I was close then, that 10%. Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney, without a calculator.
Without a calculator, just a pencil, sharp one. Now, Ms. Dalton, in all these Monday morning meetings, in all the regression analysis that you did, one of the base principles from that meeting, and we could ask the chair, we could ask Representative Wayne, he was at all these meetings, was these 85 cities that are included in that have a higher tax capacity than they're using, and in order to meet their need. Is that correct?
You want to try that again, Representative Mahoney? That face didn't look good.
Yeah, that didn't look good.
It wasn't a helpful look. No. Let's put it that way.
Like, Chair, please stop.
Fork is misunderstood.
They have a higher tax capacity than they deserve.
Could use it as they're not spending per capita as it relates to their tax capacity. Am I getting closer to what that principle was in those particular meetings?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I'm still not exactly sure, but I'm going to try, and you can tell me if I'm totally off base. The revenue need that is being used as the dependent, or the revenue base that's being used as the dependent or variable, the proxy for spending, is not all spending. I think that's what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. It is about, on average, it's about 50% of spending. It's more for some cities and less for other cities, depending on what their other sources of revenue are.
You're getting closer. But that's okay. I'll end up going down a tax line that I probably shouldn't, because I'm getting too deep into the weeds here. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
I'll skip the question, and I'll just say I know that those particular meetings we spent more time trying to figure out how to be fair to as many possible cities, as much of the population of the state of Minnesota, than we did on any other issue, because we knew that the only way we get buy-in on this particular is to get it spread as far and as wide as we possibly can and be as fair as we can. And this formula is actually explainable even for a tax neophyte like me. I can actually go to a door and say, if you got housing in this city, or housing of this age, or housing of this age, you've got needs and you've got your spending per capita, here's how the formula works. It's fairly simple. And we got 90% of the cities, or better. Well, maybe not better, but we got pretty close to 90% of the cities included in this. And if we can get 90% in this particular building or this particular complex, I we could pass a bonding bill.
Representative Linchowski. All right. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sort of thinking about passing, but it seems to me, just in general, and I'm sorry to hear there are people who want to add cities to the LGA formula. I think it's, you know, the wrong way to go, Representative Hertas. And, you know, because I think if you listen to tax analysts, they will tell you that LGA is a spending enabler. And clearly, when you've got the implicit price deflator as the measurement, you're encouraging spending. So it's always easy to spend when it's other people's money. And I'll still stand and say this is a program that, while yes, there is some need, I'd be against, you know, encouraging the growth of it. So, unfortunately, it's growing. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Representative Garofalo, did you want back in?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, for Ms. Dalton, on the runs we're seeing here, we see communities whose numbers are going down, but in the last column it lists it as a 8 increase. Are we basing that off of the previous year instead of baseline? Is that why?
Representative Garofalo, what this is showing is the increase from 2013. When I do the run of current law for 2014,
okay,
that's also what I show. And the run that I did, it's a baseline out last year. I mean, at the beginning of the session for current law 2014, did essentially the same thing.
Yep.
Representative Groff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, and thank you for doing that, because I know sometimes we just baseline, we use the numbers off of baseline law. But I mean, I actually agree with the presentation of data this way, that if we look at it from fiscal year 13 to fiscal year 14, if you're expecting a $300,000 increase and you only get a $200,000 increase, you're not being cut, you're getting a $200,000 increase. But I had a question for my friend, Representative Marquardt, because he made a comment I just want to clue in on. And he talked about, and I think I'm right here, that the LGA formula is going to be $506 million, and you said it doesn't get us to where we need to be, I think is what your words were. And I'm just wondering, you know, what does that number in your book need to be? What is that number? Because the Democrats aren't doing what they want to do right now. They're doing what they think they can get away with. If you give us the full Monty, what do you think it's going to be, Representative Marquardt?
Representative Marquardt.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Back in 2003, the certified amount was $587 million. And so we're going to be, what, 79, 70, 81 million short of that still from 2003 levels. As you mentioned, what the Democrats are doing, property tax relief is what we're doing. And just the opposite of what we've seen the last 10 years. And so we could go on to more of what we're doing, but just in this portion of it, a major component is to take the burden of property taxes off of our senior citizens on fixed incomes, our families, our farmers, our small businesses. And this approach, by trying to recoup some of the lost LGA dollars over the years, helps provide some of that property tax relief back.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. But I understand, and I disagree with your philosophy, but you guys have total control of government. You're going to pass what you want. I just want to know what that number is. I want the taxpayers of Minnesota to know. In 14, we're at $506 million. You're the one who said that that's... It doesn't go all the way. It doesn't where things need to be. I want to know what that number is. In your opinion, I don't hold your whole caucus to that number, but what do you think that number is to fully fund LGA in your personal vision?
No.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a calculator out?
Yeah, no, I don't have a calculator.
You need to borrow Representative Mahoney's pencil.
I'm just saying that what we had in 2003 certified was $587 million. If I had my druthers, I would like to see that level again. That's not going to probably occur. But I firmly believe that the dollars we put into this program, the Homestead Credit State Refund that's also out there, helps lower property taxes. And I think the more that we can lower property taxes, which is a very regressive tax, helps our senior citizens on fixed incomes out in rural Minnesota in District 4B, 21-22% of the citizens there are senior citizens. And, you know, anything you can do to relieve the burden on our families, to put a few extra dollars in their pockets, I think middle-class families is really important. So, you know, what's the number? I'd like to see it. I mean, I realize the political realities of things. We're not going to reach $587 million, but that was a high watermark at one time with inflation. I mean, the inflation, it was 587 with inflation at that time back in 2003. So I don't know if I'm answering your questions, but I do think the property tax relief, whether or not it's through local government aid, the Homestead Credit State Refund, which Representative Dabney is carrying, are very, very important property tax relief programs.
Mr. Chairman. And
Representative Garofalo.
Ms. Dalton, I just want to make sure, are these calendar year or fiscal year numbers we're seeing here for LGA?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, these are calendar year, which are paid in the next state fiscal year. So calendar year or pay 2014 is actually paid in fiscal year 15 for the state budget.
Okay.
Representative Garofalo.
Okay, so Representative Marquardt, I want to, I mean, if, is there any way I can ask the question that you're going to give me the number that says this is what LGA is fully funded at? Because if you're not, I'm not going to ask the question over and over, but is there any way I can ask that question, or is it just going to be kind of like a lot of other things? It's just going to, whatever it is, we want more.
Representative Garofalo, I think it's just a yes or no question.
No, I think I'm, well, there actually, if it was funded at 100%, I think there is a number to that on the formula. So I guess if that's what you were asking, there is a technical number, 100%. I guess then I don't know.
Ms. Dalton.
I'm not understanding your question.
Absent the partisan tennis game here, what would mathematically, I guess, be fully funding this formula?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you were going to pay 100% of the unmet need current aid gap, it would be roughly $400 million more. The total unmet need for all cities under this current formula is $827 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, is that enough? Is 820, is that the amount where you would say, you know what, we're good? $827 million, is that the goal?
Representative Marquardt, and then we're going to end this conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Representative Garofalo, I don't think that's the goal. We're being realistic. We are reversing the trend that has been set by legislatures when they have balanced the budget on the backs of property taxpayers. We are reversing that trend. And go back home, Representative Garofalo, and ask your folks if they've appreciated the property tax increases that have been hit upon their citizens. I know when I'm out and about talking to my residents, that's a huge concern. And we talk a lot about job creators. And in the last 2 years, on our job creators, our businesses, industrial, and our farmers, the economy, the increase in property taxes have been $345 million. And what gets me is I hear a lot of talk about taxes on our job creators, and yet in the last 2 years, I haven't heard a lot from a lot of members talking about $345 million of property tax increases on our job creators, on our small businesses, on our farmers. And we're saying enough is enough with this, Representative Garofalo. Enough is enough. We're going to start with local government aid. We're going to start with a homestead credit state refund to provide needed, valuable, significant property tax relief to folks. And so local government aid, I think $506 million is good. I mean, realistically, politically, that's what we can, I think we can do. Maybe, I don't know. But the key is we're telling folks out there, property tax increases and balancing the budget on your backs, no more of that. We're going to do a straight-up, honest budget and do it that way.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, very briefly, and then I thought we could hear from people who actually do local budgets.
So in closing, so that we don't get another 15 members into the conversation and wrap this up, just to be clear, Representative Marquardt, I'm just looking for a number out of you of what enough would be. And the reality is you're not willing to give me a number because with the Democrats in total control, enough government spending is a myth and a legend. It doesn't exist. It's like the boogeyman or the tooth fairy. It doesn't exist. Whatever the level of spending is, with the Democrats in total control of the state, they will be demanding even higher taxes and even higher spending, regardless of the number. You can take that to the bank, Representative Marquardt.
Representative Lean, you have some testifiers. I think go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I have in support the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, an individual from the metropolitan cities as well.
Great. One moment, please. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, if I may, before your testimony starts, Representative Lean, I just want to thank all the locally elected officials who are here. I know it's a big day today, and you're having your reception And we just appreciate so many people who have come down to hear this bill and just look forward to hearing more yet. And I know we have to come back at a later time, but before they all go off, just wanted to recognize that they're here.
Thank you for doing that, and let me extend my appreciation as well. We do only have this room until 5:45, and we do have a full agenda. So we will be reconvening in room 5 at 6 o'clock. Because we'll be recessing here at 5:45. So everybody knows I wanted to give a full airing and debate, but we do have a timeline here. Mayor Algren?
Thank you very
welcome.
Much.
Welcome. If you'd please state your name for the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Bruce Algren, A-H-L-G-R-E-N. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. I'm the mayor of the city of Cloquet and the current president of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. On behalf of our over 80 member GMC member cities, I'm here to say that we support this proposal and would like to thank Representative Legan for carrying file number 1608. Over the years, local government aid has been essential to building strong communities across the state, especially in greater Minnesota. By assisting those cities with relatively low tax bases, high needs meet those without resorting to oppressively high property taxes. Unfortunately, the LGA's reliability and effectiveness as a tax relief program has been hobbled over the past decade, and by chronic underfunding, unallotment, and year-to-year freezes of LGA payments, which prevented cuts to cities, but also prevented increase to those cities who should have gotten one. The formula wasn't working, and it's time to reboot. Last year, I was honored to be appointed by the Governor's Tax Reform Advisory Group, the local government agency, which consisted of 15 mayors from around the state, communities large, small, rural, urban, and suburban. After much discussion, we came up with a set of goals for LGA formula. Those goals were to be simple, more stable, more predictable, and more inclusive. And with fewer need factors and side pots for regional centers, small cities, or jobs and AIDS formula for simpler. I've got a bunch of other stuff here, but I think what I'm saying is property taxes, and it's the mayor of Cloquet, and I appreciate the fact that you were mayor at one time. You know, our taxes have gone up. Our property taxes have gone up. Local government aid, the city of Cloquet alone since 2003 has lost over $14 million. And that's a population of only 12,500. And we've made cuts. We've made hard cuts. And even after we probably get some local government aid, our job is to probably keep those cuts in place as much as we can and just lower our property tax rates. And that's what this job will do. $80 million is essential to bring us back at least even a little bit to where we were. And so instead of reading the rest of the stuff, I'll stop at that, and thank you very much for having us here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Algren. Mr. Sather? I thought we'd start out and we'll move in. It's the geography teacher in me. Sorry, council member.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Mark Sather, and I'm the city manager in White Bear Lake, and I'm also president of Metro Cities, an organization representing 86 cities in our metro region. We're here to support House File 1608. Metro Cities appreciates the opportunity to work with Representative Devine and other city organizations on improving the local government aid structure. We also appreciate the work of the governor and mayors on the LGA task force in providing an important starting point for this work. Metro Cities supports House File 1608 as it significantly improves the formula and allows LGA to be distributed in a more equitable manner, in a manner that's more understandable, more reliable, and more predictable. And I place emphasis on predictability. It's really important with our local budgets. LGA is a critical component of the state aid or the state and local fiscal partnership, and in recent years has been significantly reduced due to the state budget crisis. Cities in the metro area were particularly hard hit with these reductions, and many metropolitan cities no longer receive any LGA. The metropolitan area right now receives just 30% of the LGA distribution. Metro Cities legislative policies supports LGA reforms that serve the needs of our cities and more equitably in a program that better addresses the needs of our cities. many of our cities are affected, particularly those that are fully developed suburbs. They're characterized by aging infrastructure, shifting demographics, high redevelopment needs, and which have long been caught in the blind spot of the LGA program. House File 1608 better addresses these needs of metro communities and the diversity of the city needs and their characteristics. The proposed structure also improves the equity of the distribution program, as it would improve it from 30% right now to 40% under the new bill. We appreciate these improvements to the formula, but also the appropriation of an additional $80 million. This will go a long way toward restoring the aid that's been lost in over the past several years. And I'd like to just maybe conclude my remarks based on some of the conversation I heard prior, but representing a city of 25,000, which is fully developed, and I might add, we support the fact that all the metro cities, this is consistent with our board, you'll hear from Minnesota cities, you've heard from the Coalition of Osage Cities, it's pretty rare that this diverse group, which many times has had strong differences of opinion, have come together to agree on legislation. This is indeed a compromise. My particular city does not benefit from it directly. Our aid would not increase under this, but it does provide some degree of predictability that the aid that we currently receive will more likely be continued, or that we'd be able to avoid dramatic shifts in that as we approach our budget. But one of the questions that was brought up is, how would this money be used? I'd point out that I think many of you saw that over the past couple of years, a report, I believe, from the State Auditor's Office, that local units of government have really held down their property tax increases over the last few years. We bit the bullet, and I know in our community we did. We had to sacrifice a lot of the services, but we recognized that not only were our governments in dire straits, but our residents and our taxpayers were too. We went 3 years without a levy increase, and now it's time for us to start trying to make that up a little bit. We were also careful not to cut into the core services of police and fire. You often hear that. Those are our most essential services, obviously. And yet, during that time, to maintain those services, we were taking money from infrastructure improvements, parks, environmental mandates and related improvements in our city, protective inspections, and to offset other losses. In addition to losses in local government aid, we've had considerable losses ranging anything from investment earnings to permit fees and so forth. A lot of the fees that come from different sources to support our services have been dropped dramatically. So with some reinstatement of LGA, I think a lot of cities will be able to begin recovering from 3 or 4 years of very austere budgets. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Sather. Councilmember Hodges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Hodges. I am here today in my capacity as president of the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent well over 800 of the 854 cities here in the state of Minnesota. About 2.5 hours ago, the League of Minnesota Cities Board of Directors was meeting and voted unanimously to support House File 1608. The motion was moved and seconded both by members of the board who represent cities that do not get local government aid. To keep it short and simple, because I know the time is running, we of course support an increase in appropriation, but we support 1608 in particular, and we appreciate the bill being before you. We support in particular that it is a simpler formula, that it reduces volatility year over year, and that it has an inflation factor. We think it's a great bill. I think it's a moment in history that all three of these organizations are testifying and have come together to support this formula. And thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, Councilmember. I have on the list also Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. Carr? Nope. Very good. I like that answer. And Bradley Peterson from the Coalition. Picking up the trend. Any last questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Lean, any closing comments on your bill?
Other than you've heard the testimony from the various city groups around the state, and you know, I think not just the support, but the fact that they were so involved with the formula to really try to accommodate and try to please as many folks around the state as possible is very telling of the, you know, what this bill is achieving.
All right. Thank you. With that, Representative Lean renews his motion. The House File 1608, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you very much. Members and to the public, because of the tight timeline we're on, and the fact that there is a Greater Minnesota testifier on House File 1635. Representative Allen, are you still in the room? No. Bummer. Can we do this in 10 minutes?
Give this chair from the White House.
Right. Representative Simonson? Representative Simonson, the chair moves House File 1607 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Simonson, to your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'll be as quick as I possibly can. House File 1607, members, is a relatively simple, I hope, clarifying bill with respect to imposing and collection of local lodging taxes. Several cities, as you know, including my city, City of Duluth, impose a local transient lodging tax and have done so for many years, in my case, since about 1970. These taxes are, by statute, used primarily for tourism and convention center promotion. A 2011 law requires that any local lodging tax that's collected by the state to use the statutory definition of lodging in 297A as the tax base. MS 469-190 definition of lodging differs slightly, which this bill will correct to avoid any possible confusion. The main difference, members, is with the inclusion of fees charged by online travel companies. The change was made in 2011, and we are very simply bringing 469-190 into line to avoid confusion. We believe clearly it is the nationwide trend to consider internet booking company fees to be part of the taxable amount. And lastly, members, this bill will ensure a level playing field. Many smaller independent hotels, as an example, do not use internet-based booking services, while most large chains do. We should have no competitive advantages within statute. Fiscal note, which should be hopefully in your packet at least, shows no impact to any state funds. And I can state fairly comfortably that, at least in concept, the League of Minnesota Cities does support this bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Mr. Carlson, thank you for jogging in. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm on a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of an association I have represented for several years called Travel Tech. And Travel Tech is a national association of online travel companies, travel agents, and others in the tourism and hospitality business. And we do have some concerns about House File 1607 that I'd like to share with the committee. I had a chance to speak with you and with Representative Simonson earlier today about those concerns, and I would first say that it's not our position that this clarifies what the legislature did in the special session in 2011, and I'm reliving a bad memory because when they opened the Capitol on the 20th of July and let us in and we saw the bill, we were surprised to see the travel intermediary language in the tax bill that was adopted. It wasn't in either bill, and And so it has given us some concern. It took us over 12 months to negotiate with the Department of Revenue over a revenue notice of how to even implement the tax that was imposed in that bill. And we certainly don't believe, and there is dispute as to whether or not this tax applies to local lodging taxes. And just a couple things about local lodging taxes and why this gives us such concern. According to the Department of Revenue, there are 10 jurisdictions that have lodging taxes that have been passed under special laws, and there are about 120 local jurisdictions that oppose them. And I say about 120 because nobody really knows what the exact number actually is. There are only four cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Bowabic, that have the tax administered and collected by the Department of Revenue. Every other jurisdiction, about 130 jurisdictions, collect them locally. And if this bill were to pass, what you would be saying is to travel agents, all travel intermediaries, this isn't just online travel companies, that they would have to become taxpayers in every local jurisdiction and file 130 individual monthly returns, many where they would not have any activity in a month. Another problem with that is that most of the local jurisdictions don't have this information available online. We don't even have the ability to get it. Duluth, which is one of the biggest ones, biggest cities that has a local lodging tax, doesn't even have their tax forms online, nor what the rate is. And so you're asking companies to try and become local taxpayers in every jurisdiction, and that is just an administrative burden that I fear is just too high of a hurdle. And so that's the one of the main concerns that we have. The other thing that I want to make clear is that the lodging tax is not avoided through an online reservation. The online reservation and the travel intermediary tax only applies to the service that the travel intermediary charges. The other portion of that transaction gets paid to the hotelier, and they pay the local sales tax, the local lodging tax, and the state sales tax on the lodging itself. What the bill did in 2011 is it required travel intermediaries to pay the sales tax on the difference. So if I have a $60 transaction and my and it's $45 of that is for the room and $10 of that is for local taxes, that gets paid to the hotelier and they pay the local taxes. Then the online travel intermediary or travel agent pays the sales tax on that last increment. That's all we pay the sales tax on. We don't pay it on the entire amount of the bill. I'm happy to share the revenue notice with the committee, Mr. Chairman, and members on how that tax is actually being implemented, but trying to force travel agents and online travel companies to become a local taxpayer in 130 different jurisdictions is going to be extremely difficult to administer. And what I fear is that we won't have, for the tourism end of it, which I'm also very passionate about, for the tourism end of it, we won't have the offerings to market these properties in greater Minnesota, because you just can't afford the risk and the liability of being a local taxpayer and somehow being out of compliance. So that's our concerns. I've had a good conversation with Representative Simonson about those. We'd happy to answer questions, but we do have serious concerns about this provision. And it's also it's Section 29 in House File 1493 as well, in Senator or Representative Lincheski's bill. So we're watching it both places. I want to sneak past me. So
No. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson is right. We did have a discussion earlier this afternoon, and I have committed to him that as we go forward, certainly be willing to work with him and hear his concerns, and we'll try to come up with a product that meets everybody's needs. So I just want to let you and the committee be aware of that.
Thank you. Questions from members?
And
Mr. Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman and members, if we get to a product that requires travel agents and travel intermediaries to be a taxpayer in every local jurisdiction and not file one monthly return like we do with the Department of Revenue, that's going to be a significant problem. And just don't want to leave saying we can resolve that issue, because that one is going to be a very difficult hurdle. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
I can answer questions.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, with that, Representative Simonson renews his motion that House File, let's get this right, 1607 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins. Thank you. Representative Atkins, let's see, 857. The chair moves House File 857 be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we can speak about it separately, but my understanding was that we were trying to move this to the general register. So
and my understanding is that it stays here in the division.
All right, then we'll talk about that some more.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Back when I was first elected in 1871, there was a reliance upon the fire insurance premium, a small surcharge and fire insurance homeowners policies, as well as then in 1971, that was expanded auto insurance. And what it's used for is to supplement fire safety efforts. By the way, I want to welcome my co-author, Representative Davids, on the bill. This is, we've had an issue relative to police and firefighter underfunding of pensions. They come up with a solution that's about 80% reliant upon their own efforts, contributing more, asking for serving longer periods of time, seeking less out of the pension at the end, and they've solved about 80% of that on their own. With the remaining 20%, they've looked to the traditional source of funding, and that's why I referenced what happened in 1871 for fire safety and firefighter pensions, and then in 1971 for automobile insurance that supplemented police officers' pensions. And they've suggested, and I've authored the bill along with Representative Davids, a $5 surcharge on those homeowners' policies and a $5 surcharge on an auto policy, with the money being used, what it's been used for some time now, which is to assist in reaching the 90% funding level for their pensions. Now, in Invergrove Heights, where I'm from, what I would call your attention to is that we've got about $1.5 million to $2 million a year that we save as a result of having volunteer firefighters. I raise that point to you because that saves the average household in Invergrove about $150 to $160 per year. The small request in this bill, which is about $5 per premium, is a heck of a lot cheaper compared to the overall cost of having a full-time firefighting service in Invergrove. And so it's an easy call for us in a community like ours, and I think, and I'd welcome Representative Davids to offer a few comments as well, Mr. Chairman.
Before we go there, Representative Atkins, do you have the, are you offering the 857A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
And it's to get the bill in the order you prefer?
It is.
With that, members, any discussion to the chair will move the 857A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing or in hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Davids, 25 words or less.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wholeheartedly support the bill of Chair Atkins.
Nicely done. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 857? Sir.
I can't believe I did it.
Take all the time you want in the next 2 minutes.
Do what I can. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Cockey, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. That's a mouthful. And I'm here tonight to testify against House File 857, and specifically I'm here to testify against the $5 surcharge on auto and homeowners policies. We at MAFMIC believe it's bad public policy to tie a benefit to a single revenue source. Benefits should stand on their own virtues and be dispersed from the general fund. Additionally, Minnesota consumers have seen significant increases in insurance costs related to increased loss frequency and severity. The average homeowner in Minnesota has seen their premium go up 267% in the last 10 years, and this is no time to increase those costs further. Furthermore, this surcharge is regressive. The surcharge for the $100,000 sports car Adrian Peterson drives to the new Viking Stadium will be $5. And $5 for the $500 car a working mom drives back and forth from her two jobs. The surcharge will be $5 for the $1 million mansion on Lake Minnetonka and $5 for a $30,000 starter home in northern Minnesota. This is unfair to lower-income Minnesotans. Another issue that makes this bill problematic is that it calls for a $5 surcharge per policy. Some companies have multiple cars on one policy, and other companies have multiple policies for multiple vehicles. This treats consumers differently depending on whom they insure with. And how are people who refuse to pay the surcharge dealt with? This bill specifically says that the surcharge cannot be considered premium for any other purpose. This means if somebody pays their entire bill minus the $5, we cannot cancel their premium, their policy for non-payment of premium. What happens then? Members, we don't oppose the police and firefighters trying to make sure their pensions are funded, but we do think this bill in its current form has too many problems. Please oppose this surcharge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify as efficiently as that gentleman did?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, we have multiple testifiers, volunteer fighters, full-time firefighters, police officers, League of Cities, League of County, or counties, the Carlson brothers, as you know, who are frequent flyers in this committee, all prepared to testify in support of the bill. But I think what I said and what Representative David said even more succinctly sums up what they would share with the committee.
All right.
But they're here to answer any questions that the members of the committee may have.
Then let's phrase it this way. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify against the bill? All right. Questions from members? Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to be is the DFL caucus meeting here?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
that's,
I was going to suggest.
That's the
understand.
Traffic in and out.
So then my
you're welcome to join.
You sure?
Oh, I got such a great joke, but we're on TV.
Oh, yeah, we're on TV, and we're tight on
Mr.
time.
Mr. Chairman, so I'll ask Representative Davids this question then, since he's up there with Representative Atkins. Okay. Representative Davids, the DFL majority is proposing over $2 billion in tax increases. Why don't we fund this important priority from those tax increases as opposed to assessing another surcharge on the taxpayers and ratepayers of Minnesota?
Representative Atkins, Representative Davids, I'm sorry, I didn't hear who that was directed
Chairman,
to.
To Representative Garofalo, that's certainly one way to do it. We could do that. We have a history in the state of funding firefighters and ambulance-type folks from surcharges on homeowners and auto insurance. And the reason I'm on this bill is because I know that we all support our volunteer firefighters here, but what we're looking at there is there are firefighters that receive less than $1,000 per year of service. So if they've served 25 years, they might end up with a lump sum payment of $23,000-$24,000, and that's certainly not adequate. So I'm looking for a way to fund this so that debate can certainly take place. If it was an appropriation out of the general fund, that would certainly be acceptable to me, but this seems to be a way to do this with some history of doing this type of a surcharge in the past. We're looking at, as the gentleman from the Farm Mutual said, they're looking at, we've had tremendous increases in the past in homeowners. That's true because of claims and so forth. A $5 surcharge on a $3,000 homeowners policy or a $500 homeowners policy, I think most folks that I've talked to have said we'd happily do that to help out our volunteer firefighters, but if there's some other funding mechanism, I'd certainly be willing to look at that. I'm not the chief officer of the bill, but I'm certainly supporting the efforts of Chair Atkins.
And Mr. Chairman, for
Representative Groff,
thank you. For Representative Atkins, in your statement, you said that 20% is coming from the surcharge, 80% from other sources. Am I assuming then that rates of return and growth in those funds is included in that 80%?
Representative Atkins.
Representative Garofalo, all of those things are part of that 80% solution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, can you provide us with a history of when we have added surcharges to various, whatever it is, policies or other to fund? And my other question, Mr. Chair, is where does this bill sit in the Pension Commission?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, I think on the Pension Commission, it was recommended by the Pension Commission. The other portion of the question was addressed to Representative Davids.
My apologies. Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, for one example, the 2% fire surcharge for fire training for volunteer firefighters. We've had surcharges on auto insurance, but that's more to do with theft and things like that, so that really wasn't for pensions. But we have in the past. And I believe there's some others. Maybe Chair Atkins could add a few there.
Chair Atkins?
The main one I'd call your attention to, Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, is that this literally dates back in excess of 100 years relative to firefighters and 40 years on the auto side to assist with the police pension.
Representative Erickson? Thank you very much. Any more discussion from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill appears to only address the $5 and how it's going to be collected and dispersed. Where do we get to read about the reforms that are occurring to the funds?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Runbeck, I can send you the whole solution that's been proposed. I just, in summary, it's about 80% is being funded and delivered by the firefighters, police officers, and the communities for which they work. They're doing about 80%. It just didn't quite get them to that point where they were going to get to 90% funding, and that's why they started to look at and explore other options. But I'll send you the details of that, Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I would appreciate that. This has gotten a lot of publication, notification, and citizens are writing, you know, ordinary citizens saying, you know, why I don't get a bailout of my pension funds, why are we bailing out, you know, any organization with ordinary taxpayers, extracting more from our taxpayers. Do you have a great answer for that?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, I've responded to those with exactly, and I've shared with them the details that this is, number one, it's historic. This is where we've looked to fund firefighter and police pensions, as Representative Davis pointed out. And then secondly, that the firefighters and police officers are doing 80% on their own. And then finally is that this is the number one recruiting and retention tool to get volunteer firefighters right now. And we could have testimony to that effect, too. But the at the end of the day, they get a modest pension after 20 or 30 years of service. And it's a very low price to pay relative to the savings and property tax dollars in the multi-millions in a community like Inver Grove, or perhaps you have volunteers in your community as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to answer Representative Runbeck's question that is being addressed in the pension bill. I'm not sure if it's pension one or pension two, but that will be coming forward in the pension bill.
Thank you very much. And there is information in members' packets regarding the 100% solution of this, which this is 20. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Atkins, why is this pension fund underfunded?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck. I'm sorry. I'm looking at Representative Runbeck. Representative Erickson, I'm sorry. A couple reasons. One is that that the amount that's been contributed by these surcharges over the last decade in particular have dropped. And in addition to that, the investment returns in those funds have dropped. That's a pretty potent combination for ending up with an underfunded.
With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 857 is amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you very much, Representative Atkins. Thank you very much, Representative Davids. Members and audience at this time, the committee will adjourn to the call of the chair approximately 6:30 p.m. in room 5. If there's guys standing at the doors with badges, don't go in. But that's always a good rule of thumb anyways. With that, we stand in recess. Thank you. Committee will come to order. Representative Moline, House File 1646. Thank you very much. Apologize for the delay. The chair will move House File 1646 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Moline, do you have the A01 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair, and that is a delete all amendment, so I'd appreciate if you could move that as well.
All right. The chair moves the JM801 amendment to be before the committee. This is the author's amendment to get the bill in the form that she wishes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Moline, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 1646 this evening. And I'll just go through the bill briefly. I have with me Ron Dicklich, who's the executive director of Range Association of Municipalities and Schools, who's mostly here just to answer any questions that members might have. The first section of the bill is actually the Metsa bill that you heard yesterday. So I won't go through that again. The section two of the bill pays for the Metsa bill. And actually, you know, I'll just start out with talking about the taconite production tax a little bit, since so members are just familiar with what we're talking about here. There's no general fund impact to my bill. The mining companies on the range pay a taconite production tax in lieu of property taxes. They don't pay any property taxes. They pay the taconite production tax. And there's a pretty specific formula that that money goes into, and then it is distributed through the formula. So this bill is sort of moving around some of the funds within the taconite production tax formula. Section 3, members, has to do with the Taconite Economic Development Fund. That fund was first set up in the 1990s and was only 10 cents per ton. It was then changed to 30.1 cents per ton. And essentially what it is a tax rebate to the mining companies for capital improvements within the plant or mine. And so we give them essentially property tax rebate every year through the IRRRB. That's about $12 million to do capital improvements at the mine. What this bill does is reduces the 30.1 cents per ton that they're currently getting to 20.4 cents per ton. It then takes that extra 10 cents per ton and dedicates it to school bonding projects. So the IRRRB would instead use that money to issue a bond, and schools throughout the Iron Range would be able to do bonding projects so that they can have capital investments and improvements at the schools. Basically, right now, members, everybody else's property taxes are going up, including businesses and homeowners. And that's not currently the case on the range with the mining companies. Historically, I've had, you know, House Research put a spreadsheet together for me about historically the taxes that the mining companies pay. They pay a cents per ton. It's not a percentage of income or a percentage of what they sell a ton of ore for. Historically, the taconite production tax rate relative to the price of ore, meaning what they're selling a ton of ore for, has been around 6.1%. It's currently 2.4%. So they are selling ore sometimes 300% higher than what they've sold it for in the last 20 years, yet their taconite production tax has gone down. The impact of the taconite production tax has decreased by 55%. Just looking at the numbers, you know, I think that it's reasonable at this time to invest in our schools throughout the district and to make sure that they have proper capital improvements by reducing that tax rebate that goes to the mining companies. I can't think of any other industry, I guess, throughout the state that's getting a multi-million dollar tax rebate for making capital improvements within their facility that they would need to be making anyways. Section 4 of the bill has unspecified dedications to the city of Hibbing and to the city of Mountain Iron. And these are costs that have been incurred as a result of mining. We are trying to get the company, especially in the case of Hibbing, to pay for some of these costs. Just to give members an idea, right now the city of Hibbing, 4 years from now, we'll only have enough water for 20% of the population. We're probably going to run out of... We won't have enough water by this summer for all of the population of the city, and that's because Hibbing Taconite, because of their mining operations, have drained the Scranton Well, which was one of the biggest providers of water to our city. Because of that, the city has located another well in a different aquifer that they will have to drill so that they have enough water for the city. So what we're doing right now is trying to get the company to contribute to that well so that it's not on the taxpayers of the city of Hibbing. But there is an undedicated amount in this bill, and the money would come from reserves that we have in the homestead property tax credit, so that there wouldn't be direct property tax increases for the homeowners and business owners of Hibbing who are having to deal with basically spending millions of dollars to drill in a new well because Hibbing Taconite has drained the Scranton well. There's also an undedicated amount to the city of Mountain Iron for the cost of moving utilities as a result of U.S. Steel expanding. And again, we're still in the process of meeting with the city to see exactly what their financial amount or financial requirements will be. Section 5 of the bill is just the language that I've already talked about where the IRRRB would issue a bond for the schools. And again, that money comes from the 10 cents per ton that's currently going as a tax rebate to the mining companies. And I think that sums up the bill. Unless you have anything. And so then we would stand for questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Moline. Representative Moline, if not for the language on 421 and 422 of the DE amendment, the unspecified revenues to the city of Hibbing and the city of Mountain Iron, how would those local governments pay for, what is it, things related to the water supply in Hibbing and things related to utilities in Mountain Iron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, basically, utility rates would probably go up quite significantly in order to pay for a new well. Like I said, they're actually having to locate the well about 6 miles from where the city actually is because they had to find another aquifer because Hibbing Taconite drained the aquifer that the city was getting their water from. And so they have to locate the new well about 6 miles outside of the city and then build the infrastructure in order to get the water to the city. And so it is going to be a substantial cost. So in Hibbing, we have a municipal utility source. So I would bet that our rates would go up pretty high in order to pay for that new well.
All right. Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, I think in your introduction you referred to the discount of the production tax as a property tax refund, and I think you meant to call that something else. Is that correct?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, not really, because they don't pay a property tax. They pay a taconite production tax in lieu of a property tax. So it is their property tax equivalent. So essentially, it's a property tax rebate.
Representative Hertas.
Okay, I don't want to split hairs. I just thought for the record you'd want to be clear about that because it is a production tax credit, not a property tax credit.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's the taconite production tax that they pay in lieu of property taxes. So if you don't want to use the term property tax rebate, you could use the term production tax rebate.
Okay. Representative Hertas.
You spoke a little bit to the revenues, and we don't have that information or chart, but has the mining operation, it seems my recollection of the taconite and iron ore industry as a boy growing up, it kind of peaked and then it kind of died and it kind of revived itself. And what is, just tell me a little bit about, you know, has the production actually been increasing recently? Has the revenues been going up because of increased demand? Have they found new technologies on how to reclaim some of the lower grade ore? I mean, is that actually working and helping for the area?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, we had, having lived on the Iron Range my whole life, I'm very used to the ups and downs of the industry. A few years ago, it was pretty hard times. Production had dropped significantly. We're back up to full production, around 38 million tons a year. And what you're referring to is Scram Mining. Probably the most recognizable company would be Magnetation. And what they do is process the old tailings pile. And because of technology created at the University of Minnesota through research, they're able to extract ore in what we thought before was just waste, basically. And so, yes, there have been job benefits to the region because of that. If you look at what the mining companies are paying in an occupation tax right now, which is their equivalent of the corporate income tax. Mining companies also don't pay the corporate income tax. They pay what's called an occupation tax. And if you look at those numbers, they've gone up significantly over the past couple of years. And that is tied to the income that they're making in Minnesota.
Representative Perkos.
Representative Moline, Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification. So it sounds like during the most recent times, the revenue stream in terms of production tax and the occupation tax has been going up.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do three-year averaging with our revenue because of the boom and bust nature of the industry. And like I said, we recently had a big bust in 2008, 2009, and we're coming out of that. And so the revenues have gone up because we're currently coming out of that three-year cycle, which was very, very low revenues. I'd also note that the Taconite Economic Development Fund doesn't get paid to the mining companies if their production falls below 30 million tons a year. So right now we're hovering at around 38 million tons a year. I would bet that that's what we're going to stick with for a while. I hope it doesn't fall below that. But if it does fall below 30 million tons a year, then the companies don't get the Taconite Economic Development Fund money.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you for that clarification.
All right. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Representative Mullane or for staff, what is 126C55? And subdivision 3 of section 5 of the bill. I'm looking specifically at lines 16 and 17. It says the IRRR, it's a district for purposes of Minnesota statutes under 126C.55.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the statute book in front of me, so maybe staff can answer, but isn't it?
The cavalry. Oh. Mr. Michaels? Since you probably wrote this.
126C55.
Yeah, exactly. If you can help us with Representative Garofalo's question. Can you identify yourself for the tape? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Joel Michael from House Research. Steve, I think, is looking this up, but basically what, and I don't, because this is a school finance statute,
yeah,
I don't have,
but
it refers to, essentially, what's going on here is the commissioner of the IRRR is issuing bonds, and basically what this is saying is that for purposes of the state credit enhancement program that applies to school districts, what we're going to do is to treat the bonds that were issued by the commissioner on behalf of the range school districts as if the commissioner were a school district for purposes of that credit enhancement program, which I suspect this is one of these questions that Representative Garofalo is asking because he knows the answer.
No. I want to be respectful.
Representative Garofalo.
I saw 126C. I know what 126C is. I didn't know what .55 was.
Right.
And I was just concerned and alarmed whenever I see the IRRR inserting itself into the school portion. Just while you're up there, just a quick question, because I don't know if staff knows. For purposes of debt service equalization, would this be factored into their calculation of property wealth or their ability? Because right now there are certain loans that are out there that we're making payments on. Would this be factored into their wealth, or is this just going to be, we're going to pretend that that's not taking place?
Mr. Michaels.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, now you try to drag me into the school finance world. I'm not going.
That's why I left. I don't. It's like Lord of the Rings. I don't want to go back either. Trust me.
But what this does is it just authorizes the IRRRB to issue bonds on behalf of school districts for capital projects. And my assumption is that all of the school finance calculations would go on for their other debt as is. And this, yes, this will reduce their need for regular debt because they can provide some of their capital facilities through this program, but it doesn't affect how much they're levying to pay if they have other bonds and how much aid they would get under this, under the equalization formula. So basically, I guess you could say that if you're, because they're not levying for this, you know, they have more capacity and so they will get less equalization. But you should ask Tim Strom that question.
Well,
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, the reason I am happy that you brought that up is because mining companies, because they don't pay property taxes, they don't help paying on referendums for school construction, whereas every other business and homeowner in town does. So that's one of the benefits that they have right now for not paying property taxes is they don't pay on school construction referendums.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
First of all, let me do my best Ron Abrams impersonation.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
So just I want to be respectful. I know we're in the tax committee, but you are correct, Representative Moline, but for purposes of determining property wealth, that's not part of the adjusted net tax capacity formula, so it gives districts they are property poor. And so if we're going to be tapping into that revenue stream to provide for this, I want members of the committees, particularly those from who are not from the range, to know what's going on in the education side of things here, that Representative Moline is exactly right, that those are not considered for purposes of tax capacity. They don't pay them. But the flip side to that is they qualify for aid from the state. And so if you're going to be tapping into that as a revenue stream, then that should be a calculation of what their wealth is. And I just would want that noted. I don't know if anyone cares or not, but it's just an important fact to know for purposes of equalization.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. May I ask Representative Garofalo to yield?
Certainly. We don't normally do that in committee, but go right ahead.
Representative Garofalo, did we ever have a spreadsheet that showed what these individual districts received in their taconite aid and then anything that would be subsequently awarded to them because of this industry?
Well, Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson. No, because it's not a general education funding source. But I would, just since we're, you know, I used to chair the Education Finance Committee, and
so now you're moving to impressions of.
Oh, that's me. But no, I think it's just important to understand that mechanism. I wasn't trying to be critical of the idea. Not just people need to understand that if we're going to be the calculations we use to determine whether a district is property poor for purposes of referendum and for purposes of bonding, whether it's tax capacity, referendum market value, do not include the taconite provisions that Representative Moline is counting on. But if we're going to be directing that revenue to the school districts, and this is a local revenue source, that's what it is, it's in lieu of property taxes, then members on both sides of the aisle should be aware that that is taking place. It's the majority party can decide whether that's fair or not. That's up to them. But I just think it's part of the equation that people need to realize is that this is not just this is sometimes we just kind of cut off the iron range and say it's your money. You guys do what you want. Spend how you want. That's what happened in 2007 when they took money out from the schools up there, distributed it to cities, and it resulted in the state of Minnesota it took education dollars and provided local government aid grants to cities up there. Because people didn't understand the interactions of what were going on. And I just, for members of the Democrat, the majority party, just keep an eye on this and watch it because there are interactions that are not readily apparent.
Representative Erickson.
And Mr. Chair and committee, I'm just curious to see how their aid from this program compares to the rest of our school districts. So maybe I'll pursue getting from the school districts those amounts. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just...
Representative Garofalo.
Representative Erickson, I'll help you make... If you want to make your argument, you should just look at the Education Omnibus Bill of 2011, because the Iron Range school districts, particularly those under 1,000, got some of the largest per-pupil funding increases in the state. So that's a much better argument than the taconite tax, because no one understands it.
Yeah. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, I see there are a number of blank items in this bill. When will those numbers be filled in?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. It's this bill is a work in progress. We're still meeting with the cities and the companies to see what the actual needs are for the cost of the well in Hibbing and for the cost of moving utilities in Mountain Iron because due to U.S. Steel operations.
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And the blank appropriation in relation to the revenue bonds?
Mr. Chair, Representative, same thing. We're, you know, waiting to see what the size of the bond issued would be relative to the revenue and the needs of the school districts.
The division report will be marked up April 3rd, is it? 3rd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, could do you have any knowledge of the history of the Taconite Economic Development Fund and why it was set up?
Representative Moline.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I do. It was set up in the early 90s, and like I said, it was only 10.4 cents per taxable ton at that time. It has increased in 2002, they increased it to 30.1 cents per ton. There have been times when we didn't do the Taconite Economic Development Fund because production fell below the 30 million tons. But it was set up, at the time it was set up, it was because I believe that there were capital improvements that needed to be made that the companies weren't making. So it was set up to give them money to do so.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when this fund was set up, was it envisioned to do anything besides capital improvements for the mines?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no. The default is, so the money goes to the Taconite Economic Development Fund, and then we distribute it at the IRRRB. If for some reason we weren't to distribute it, the fallback is the revenue goes to the Doug Johnson Fund and the Environmental Protection Fund, which is essentially our public works fund. There was a time 2 years ago, actually after the homestead tax credit was eliminated, that we withheld some of the TEDF payments to the mining companies and instead did public works projects on the Iron Range that needed to get done. So if we don't give the rebate to the mining companies, the default is the DJJ fund or the Environmental Protection Fund.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to hear from the industry.
Is there anyone from the industry present who wishes to testify? There is. Good evening, sir. Please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. First, I want to thank the representative. The amendment looks a lot cleaner than the original bill, and I understand they've made some changes. It would still result in about a $4 million reduction in what can be used for the Taconite Economic Development Fund by the mining companies. And we are at a time when things are looking a lot better from when this was originally brought in. The business plans of the mines are different. Most notably are the mines that are vertically integrated. So the iron ore that they have goes directly to their steel plant. It's kind of like a farmer having in his own seed. However, there are times yet when we do hit some very lean times based on the economy. Like any large industry, we have our ups and downs with what's going on with the economy. We did see that in 2009, and there was a time when we didn't receive the TEDF, and there was another time that we didn't receive all the amounts. What I'm wondering is, I have some ideas that I'd like to talk to the representative, the author, about that I think we could almost do the very same thing that she's trying to do, which I applaud. We do need more in our schools. We've been working very closely with the Range delegation, but I think there might be some ways that we still can protect those times when maybe it gets lean for the mines. And what they do with it is, so you have a little more understanding, that if there's capital items, what we can do is leverage corporate dollars that we probably would not get, and those projects would not be done in the lean times. It was something that was worked out with the Range delegation back in the early 90s, and they've been working on ever since. So it's for many years, it's kind of been a work in progress. So I guess at this time, rather than going through what possibility of what could be done, I'd be willing to keep working with the representative. I applaud what they're trying to do with the schools. They've been great schools, and they continue to be. But like all schools right now, they need some help as well. There might be another way we can do it and still have the same benefit.
All right. Any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 1646? Good evening, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you,
state Mr. your name for the record and proceed
Thank
with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Hammond from Sudan, Minnesota, home of the first iron mine in Minnesota. I worked in several of the mines, and I didn't intend to testify until I heard some of the comments made, and it seems we've been discussing mining taconite taxes and education funding, probably two of the most complicated subjects we could have picked on to talk about at the same time. And I'm not sure if I'm understanding the discussion correctly. It seems to be people perhaps think that we're getting a special deal as residents of northern Minnesota with funding of our schools. And I'd like to point out first that a little less than 2 years ago, our high school closed. Tower Sedan High School closed. And I'd like to point out that we vote for referendums to raise our taxes. We make sacrifices for our kids. And then I would close by mentioning a study that came out a few weeks ago from the University of Minnesota in Duluth. That study examined the job creation. And of course, B and I worked in the mines and occasionally come down to the cities to work with the boom and bust in mining. I thought I had a good understanding of the economics of mining, but that report was a little bit of an eye-opener in that it said that the mining industry creates more jobs in the metro area than it does on the Arrowhead in Minnesota. It creates more jobs in Minneapolis and St. Paul than it does in Virginia and Hibbing. So I would suggest that people who believe that somehow we're taking advantage of the system are mistaken. Now, I'm not a big advocate of mining for community development. I don't think it works anymore. They don't hire enough people to sustain our communities. But the Iron Range of Minnesota is not taking advantage of the rest of the state, and I would thank you for your support. I know that the headwaters of the Mississippi are right near Hibbing, and we know that water runs downhill from Hibbing to St. Paul, and I'd like to see some money run uphill from St. Paul to Hibbing. So, help that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tavin. Very much. Representative Moline, any closing comments that can top his?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think I could ever top Bob. That was nice. I actually didn't know he was going to be here today, so I thank him for those comments. But just so members are aware, and I think he summed it up the best, if any of you think that we have a big windfall from the mining industry on the Iron Range in our communities, in our towns, in our schools, I would invite you to come up. Come up next week over the Easter break. I will take you around to our schools. Our schools are very old. In Hibbing, our school was built in 1919. Virginia around 1910. Chisholm, 1924. Nashwauk, 1918. These are some schools with some serious needs. Even if you're talking about technology upgrades, in Hibbing High School, for example, which is 7th through 12th grade now, the walls are all concrete. They can't just put wireless in the school, not like they do here in the new schools where they can put wireless throughout the school. There are major infrastructure changes that have to take place when all the walls are concrete. Very costly. Our schools are very old. Our education, and I have a lot of pride in where I came from. I graduated from Hibbing High School, and I think I turned out okay. I don't know, some of the Republicans might disagree, but But we do have some major, major education needs in our communities. We don't have a big windfall from the mining companies. So if you want to tour our schools and our towns, I'd be happy to take you there. So that's an open invitation to committee members, Mr. Chair.
Uh-oh. Representative Mahoney.
I just want the committee to understand that your predecessor, well, not your predecessor, but one of the previous Iron Range members, Tommy Rukavina, used that ruse on me and got me to tour Hibbing High School and a variety of others, and absolutely delightful high school, and you're correct. You turned out perfect.
Thank you. I didn't pay him to say that.
No.
The
quote
I need later.
Yeah, exactly. There's a trade-off there somewhere. All right. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1646, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Moline, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Allen. Representative Faust, would you like to move House File 1635 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Representative Allen, good evening. Welcome. Thank you. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1635, this bill raises two issues. I think it's intended to, because it'll be laid over, intended to open a door here for further analysis, further work. I have discussed this bill and heard the concerns and with the assessors, the Hennepin County, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. And so this bill raises two issues. The first is whether the current tax results for Class 4D property is not sufficient and needs adjustment. And so this bill was brought, obviously, by those who believe that the tax results do need adjustment. And so the second issue is whether that adjustment should be made to the valuation method as proposed by the language in this bill, or by adjusting the classification rate, which I believe was the last adjustment was made in, I think it was 2005. It went from, for 4D, it went from 1.25 to 0.75. And so those are the two issues. And so this bill, it changes the valuation method by limiting the market value and taxable value to a value that may not exceed 100,000 times the number of dwelling units. And again, 4D is the low-income housing, which is Section 8. Those receiving certain federal tax credits, and then others that are all under sort of rental assistance and rent and income restricted property. So, do we have a testifier here?
I know that there is one in opposition. If I can find my notes, Mr. Heidelberger, did I get that right?
Yes.
Very good. Mr. Heidelberger, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reed Heidelberger. I'm the city assessor for the city of Alexandria, appearing before you tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. As Representative Allen said, we did get a chance to talk a little bit about this bill. I certainly appreciate that opportunity. And yes, the assessing community does have some concerns about using market value limitations as a method of aiding the subsidized housing. We would suggest respectfully that perhaps looking at the class rate would be a better way to go. That has been done in the past, as Representative Allen mentioned. We feel that any time you place limits on the assessor's market value, it tends to make the system, the tax property tax system, more complicated, more difficult to explain to property tax payers, and that the class rate option might be a better rate to go.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heidelberger, is this necessary to change in state law, or can this adjustment be made through the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson.
Mr. Heidelberger.
To change the class rate, it would have to be changed in statute. It's currently set in statute at 0.75%.
Representative Allen.
And it's set in statutory section 273.13, subdivision 25. So it would be for the 4A property and 4D property and subdivision 25, section E.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Heidelberger, would this be setting a precedent if this action were taken to, it sounds like in my notes, this is for one Section 8 piece of housing, probably located in Minneapolis. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it might be. Wouldn't this be setting a precedent for all other housing that falls under that?
Mr. Heidelberger.
I would defer to Representative Allen.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, it's intended to apply to all 4D properties, and then there's a clause that it will take into consideration 4A property in the subsequent years.
Mr. Heidelberger, what happens when an assessor assesses the value of a limited a property where the rent is limited by federal tax credits that were used in the financing of the construction, and they assess it at a value above what the rent that can be charged on that property?
Mr. Chair, currently the statute for 4D properties requires assessors to assess 4D properties like all other properties using the same methodology. If we would get to a situation where that property, where the assessed value was higher than the construction cost, that is something certainly that a property taxpayer, the property owner could bring to our attention. We could look at those figures, but we are required by statute to assess those properties the same as all other properties.
So, Mr. Heidelberger, the fact that the property can't be used, could not be sold for general purposes because of the tax credits that were used, the rent is limited, doesn't come into the computation. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chairman. We're assessing it, again, the same as any other rental property. We're looking at market rate rents that would be charged in the area. We're looking at sales of comparable properties, looking at the cost of constructing that property, same as we would for any other rental properties.
Mr. Heidelberger, is it appropriate to use market rate rents as a measure when market rate rents aren't able to be charged in a 4D property?
Mr. Chair, when we're trying to arrive at a market value for the property, yes, we'd be looking at the market rents for that property, assuming that if the property came on the market, it would be a possibility it would no longer be in the 4D program. It could be market rate housing at that time. An owner can withdraw properties from the 4D program as well. So, yes, we're using market rate rents to evaluate those properties.
Thank you. Mr. Michael? I'm sorry. You do property tax, right? You don't do school funding, but you do property taxes? I don't know if you're the best person. I'm in the deep end of the pool for me on understanding the federal tax credits that I think can be used to construct these properties and what that means for rents that can be charged, resaleability, things like that. Can you shed any light? Or is there another staff member who would be, I'm sorry, another staff member would be a better source?
Mr. Chairman, Joel Michael from House Research again. The federal tax credit programs, along with some other programs that end up financing these low-income projects, frequently contain a contract that requires them to rent units to individuals who have qualifying income and to charge no more rent than a specified level that's set by HUD, called fair market rents. And so contractually, for a period of time, you know, I'm not sure what usually the periods are, you know, 15, 20, or 30 years, they're obligated to essentially live by that contract that was part of qualifying for tax credits. And so they cannot, for those units that are the qualifying units, charge more than that rent. The assessors, though, under their normal methods, do not take those contracts into account. They assess, I mean, they're better at telling you about this on a fee simple basis, where they look at what would this property be worth without regard to the contractual restrictions that apply to it. And I think the analogy they might provide to you is if the owner of a rental property or an office building or something like that makes a poor economic decision and enters into a disadvantageous 20 or 30 year lease, for example, with a tenant that's locked that owner into rent that's lower than what the current market rent is, and they can't get out of that lease, and anybody who buys that building will also get it subject to that lease. They don't adjust the value of the building or the value of the property for that, and I think they would say they would treat these tax credit restrictions in the sort of the same, consistently in that same way. The difference is that they're imposed by the United States government pursuant to the federal tax law and HUD financing and so on. But I think they're better at explaining this than I am. But I think that's the nub of the issue that's involved here, that the value that's on this property, doesn't reflect the fact that they can't charge rents that enable them to recover, what other landlords in the same vicinity would be able to charge.
Mr. Michael, I assume that these tax credits are used in financing the construction. Are there instances, and maybe you're the person in the room and maybe someone else is, where they would be used for remodeling or something, or would we only see this with the construction of new property?
Mr. Chair, these tax credits can be used for substantial rehabilitation. So sometimes you will have a developer come in with, an existing building that they're going to, substantially fix up so that it's available for rental. That's a very common situation.
Thank you. Mr. Hagan, do you want in on this?
Please.
Mr. Hagan, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division. And I'd like to give a little background on 4D and how we got where we are. For a number of years before the legislature made it, a lot of changes to simplify it, it was an incredibly arduous process to try to value the 4D properties. MHFA had to certify values and amounts to the assessors, and it was really, really complicated and extremely complex. Over a period of years, we working with MHFA and legislators, we found a way to reduce the complexity of it a great deal by valuing it at like other market value apartments and reducing the class rate to where market value apartments pay a class rate of 1.25, 4D properties pay a class rate of 0.65. So that's sort of the history. That's sort of how we got there. As far as the issue before you, we do recognize there's a problem. We've met with people who have informed us that a lot of times some of these properties are built based on an expectation that the tax will not exceed $900. So to cash flow the subsidized housing, they expect a tax of about $900 per unit. In some instances, because of escalating values, the taxes are exceeding $1,800, so twice what they were actually predicting and projecting. So it's putting them in kind of a financial crisis to try to sustain the existence of these 4D properties. And certainly, Representative Allen has a solution that is an interesting solution. We're a little concerned about a statewide class rate that would affect properties throughout the state, because you'd have the corresponding tax shifts onto all other properties if the class rate was reduced again. So you sort of have the issue of, do you want to try to deal with some individual properties? And I think Representative Allen's solution is reasonable, to cap the properties at $100,000, which would not affect a lot of properties. The trade-off is it does add another tier of complexity. But if you were to reduce the class rate in all 4D property, there would be tax shifts throughout the state, and properties that were not having any problems cash flowing would see the tax benefits at the expense of all other taxpayers.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Representative Runbeck, you've been patient. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes.
All right, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just reinforce what you heard from the assessor. In the regulations in banking and mortgage and finance, as well as appraisal, there are uniform standards that have to be applied in terms of providing the financing, the banking and the lending and the federal guarantees and mortgage insurance want to ensure that there's good market rate appraisals so that they understand, you know, what the loan-to-value ratios are and that the financing is being properly applied. And with that, when appraisers look at property, there's three approaches that they can take to determining value. One is the market value, second is the income approach, and the third is the cost approach. Now, what we're seeing over time is that both, even though we've seen a bubble in the housing industry, there's actually been a rise in the values of multifamily dwellings and apartments because of an increased demand for rental property as a result of the housing bubble. We've also seen that costs haven't continued to decline. And from an income approach, that is really a factor of what would that property be able to produce in terms of total income in an uninhibited market, you know, one that wouldn't be subsidized. So I think it's kind of a dangerous precedent to go down the road that we are. It really sounds like we're now creating a 56th classification of property, but it might be a more appropriate way in terms of defining what is public housing or tax exempt housing or something like that. But I think the ratio of how you apply the tax rate to that property value is really at issue here in terms of what the goal is. But I don't think we should be tinkering with obfuscating values, because the industry needs to use those values to make good market comparables for other types of housing that need financing. And if you are creating a subordinate market by undervaluing properties, you're depressing in the market approach the value of property that you can use as good comparables to obtain financing to provide what is our end goal, is to provide more housing. So those are my comments that I would add to that.
Well, the chair's question, though, is under Representative Allen's bill, you're getting a more accurate representation of the value of the property than the current process yielded, because the property cannot be sold for the value that
But that's irrelevant, is what I'm saying. The property still needs to be appraised and valued at its current market conditions, regardless of what the subsidies are or whatever. That is a uniform application of what the assessor's task is and what appraiser's task are, is to treat all properties the same. They make comparable adjustments accordingly based on, you know, what the differences are. But, I think it's a dangerous precedent to be going down.
All right. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Allen, do you have any idea how many properties would be affected by this change?
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. That is something that Hennepin County will be taking a look at.
Apparently it's in the note.
533
properties. And how big a decrease in value is involved? Is that in that sheet also? How big a decrease is involved in these properties in decrease in value?
Representative Allen?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that number. I haven't seen that report.
Just to clarify the reference, there's 533 apartment properties that have a per unit average market value greater than $100,000. What we don't know is how many of those this bill would apply to, because this bill only applies to 4D properties with that value. So we've got a universe of 533 and a specific number of we don't know yet.
And we don't know how big the decrease would be either.
That appears to be correct as well.
Thank you.
Ms. Van Mosch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan Van Mosch with the Department of Revenue. We are working with the department, or with Minnesota Housing Finance, to use their information to identify the number of 4D properties that would be affected by this proposal. So typically, if we have a revenue estimate like we do here with an unknown, In this situation, we just don't have the information we need right now to do that assessment, but we're hoping that in working with housing finance, we'll be able to refine the estimate and actually answer the question from Representative Torkelson.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, Representative Allen, any closing comments?
I would just add, Mr. Chair, that I think we've identified the relevant issues here is whether you were talking about using some sort of restricted income approach that mm-hmm. really accurately reflects that the actual expenses and the restricted rents here, that the market value really, how it really doesn't, I mean, I know that it may serve a useful purpose, but the rate reduction, it just seems that if we could come up with some way that could take into account the actual reality of what it's like for these properties to operate under these restricted rents and in the expenses. So.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1635 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus report. Thank you, Representative Allen. Well, because I thought I'd let her do that.
Not here, though.
I know, but we're going to go get her. I'll do mine, though.
Oh, do you have this another?
I've got more. Yeah, sorry. But if you work with me here, mine can be brief.
Oh, serious.
Do you mind?
No, not at all. The good old days.
There you go.
Representative Dabney, Mr. Chairman, did you want the bill to be laid over for possible inclusion?
I do, please.
All right. Representative Dabney moves that House File 796 be moved for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Dabney, do your bill.
Members, over the last decade or more, this legislature has authorized a number of entertainment venues. Actually, we can go back even further than that. Number of entertainment venues in the Twin Cities. Each of those venues has a different governance structure. Each of those venues has a different financing structure. Unfortunately, some of those venues compete against each other. And so we have a situation where taxpayer-subsidized venues are pitted against each other in a competition that only increases the taxpayer subsidy and does nothing for the public benefit. What House File 796 directs the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul to establish a joint governance structure for the Target Center in Minneapolis and the Excel Center in St. Paul. And by January 1st of 2015, and first to report to us by February 1st of 2014, progress towards this, the feasibility of placing the facilities under the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, also better known as the Viking Stadium, folks, and work with the professional sports teams that are the primary tenants of that these two facilities. With me tonight, I have a number of people who could speak to this as needed. Representative Mahoney and I have worked in this policy area for several years. And he is the co-author on the bill, and I appreciate his efforts here.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing no additional testimony, we'll take questions from members. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, what do they do in other cities where they have multiple entertainment sports centers such as we do between the two cities?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson. I can't answer authoritatively, but anecdotally, my understanding is that in many of our competing markets that have sports venues, those venues are owned by the teams, not by the public. And so there, if you have competition between different venues, you have two private businesses that are duking it out, and they're not receiving the taxpayer subsidies that these two venues are.
Seeing no further questions, any additional comments, closing comments, Representative Dabney?
No, thank you very much.
With that, Representative Dabney renews his motion to have House File 796 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, at this time, we have one last bill on the agenda, Representative Loeffler's. She is, I believe, completing a bill in Health and Human Services, Finance. Perhaps, Mr. Chair, if we could stand in recess to the call of the chair. Hopefully it'll be brief.
Did you just want to start the bill, or do you want to recess? It's up to you.
I'd rather allow Representative Loeffler to...
With that, the committee is recessed to the call of the chair.
Thank you very much.
I bet you will.
Oh, yeah. That's never yours. It's, you know, it's one thing to share. You actually got it. That's right. That's a lot more. Yeah, that's the guy who's trying to.
I have these. Yeah. They sent me. You used to get them all the time. Okay.
Make sure this isn't mine. Committee will come to order. Representative Loeffler, from one out of the frying pan and into the fire. Welcome to the welcome back.
I am glad to be back, sir. I couldn't be here for your full illustrious hearing. It's always Stacey on deadline week. House File 1647. I would like to move for possible consideration in the omnibus tax
Thank you very much.
Excuse me. And we've had a lot of testimony on the renter's credit and how it works and all the options, and so I don't think we need to go through that. I'll just tell you how this bill differs from some of the many alternatives that we've looked at. And as we've heard, that the renter's credit works really well right now for people who are elderly and disabled and very low income, and we want to continue that. This bill doesn't change any of that. What it does do is it does increase the maximum, and it provide additional benefits up to a higher level of income, going up to $75,000 per year in household income. What it really, the goal of this is, and the biggest benefit is going to be really for the working poor families, those who are making, you know, have a couple with maybe one or two or three kids who are making $10 to $12 an hour, and they're just living on the edge. They can't save up to do a down payment and get into home ownership. And so we're going to try and make sure that the renter's credit works for the working poor, in addition to seniors and the disabled who are, tend to be at those lower incomes, without affecting them. And so that's what this bill does. I have to give much praise to Ms. Manzi, who brought her always impressive skills to the how do we do this. And you can see from the bill that it basically would provide for those working poor families an amount that would be probably, you know, depending on their income level, you know, could be $1,000 to $1,500
for the people who are at the top end of this area, which would be a household income of $70,000 to $75,000, it would be $160, which, you know, really isn't very much. But it really is focused in on that working poor family that might right now be really struggling, and who clearly are paying property taxes and their rent. And I think we had, right now the homeowners program goes up to $103,000 of income, so this doesn't begin to approach what we do for homeowners, but it does update our renter's credit maximums to a more realistic household income compared to the last time we dealt with this.
Thank you very much. Do you have any testifiers?
No, I don't. I have people who'd be glad to respond to questions, but given the late hour and what I might be quickly called upstairs to do, I would be glad to respond to questions.
All right. I hope that's not a metaphysical comment. Representative Erickson.
I hope so, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, you have an inflationary increase built in here?
Representative Loeffler.
Is that what Clause C says in Section 2, Subdivision 4?
Representative Erickson, this does not have anything in change in current law other than updating that reference to 2013. It's just updating that from the year 2000. I don't think it changes the base, but Ms. Manzi could always clarify that if I'm not interpreting that wrong.
Ms. Manzi can stay where she is. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler and Erickson, you're right that we're not changing anything in this bill, but the program is already indexed, has been for some time, and this just continues that indexing at the new levels.
Thank you. That clarifies it. So it's indexed. It's not inflation. It's indexed. Okay. Thank you.
Right. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some background perhaps from staff. These income levels, are they AGI? Have we ever taken into consideration number of members of the household? You know, is it a one person, four person, anything like that coming into this picture?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, we do take into account household size. There are deductions allowed for the more people in the household there have, and the income measure used is a broader measure of income than, I can't remember if you asked about adjusted gross, but it does bring in other sources of non-taxable income, such as Social Security, et cetera. But there are other, it's considered to be a broad measure of household income.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, this is reflecting after deductions and so on?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, it would be, you know, it would be on the income side, it would be before sort of the deductions you make for your income tax purposes, but then this program itself does allow you to deduct for household size, so it wouldn't bring in income type deductions like charitable contributions, mm-hmm. but it would bring in the household size deductions.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 1647? Any last comments, Representative Loeffler?
No, Mr. Chair, just glad to have your consideration and appreciate your interest in this.
Thank you very much. With that, House File 1647 is laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Members, just a reminder that we come back on April 2nd. The division report will have been posted. We'll walk through the report at that time. On the 3rd, we will first allow public comment on the report, and then if there are any amendments, we will consider them at that time and complete on the division report on the 3rd. So could be a long day or not. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you comment on the amendment process as to how you're going to handle that?
You offer them, we vote them down.
Yes, I figured as much.
did you need more direction than that, sir?
I wanted to make sure that we could find a good stormy day in terms of attendance.
That meeting. Actually, this majority is committed to an honest budget arrived at in public. Representative Hertaus.
All right.
Remind you of that.
But they'll get here via public transit.
Hopefully.
Okay. Thank you.
Hopefully. That would help the environment.
All right.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.